Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program 396, titled Economics, Geopolitics, and Proxy War in the Middle East. This is being recorded on January 26th of 2003. Now, I will have made many references in Side 1 and will make references in Side 2 to other elements of research and other programs. The entire For the Record series is being archived by sister station WFMU on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked both to the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio-equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 396 within a week or so of the recording of this broadcast. Spitfire also, by the way, has the other materials that I've recorded over the years available for a very small fee. I do not get money from that arrangement. Now, in discussing the admittedly very complex theme of this program, in talking about economics, geopolitics, and proxy war in the Middle East, bear in mind the concept of the virtual state and the underground Reich, which I spoke about in Side 1. Bear in mind the economic theories of Friedrich Liest at the core of the European Monetary Union. Bear in mind also the theories of Karl von Clausewitz. Also, keep in mind the theories of fascist theoretician Francis Parker Yockey that we've spoken about in the past. Yockeyism is a manifestation of fascism that aims to unite third world elements, left and right wing elements in an anti-American and anti-Semitic fascist coalition, and we're going to be talking about that later in the program. Now, in For the Record 394 and 395, I spoke about what I have conceptualized as the Battle of Menwith Hill. This is a complex theme, and again, I refer people to the programs that I have cited, For the Record 394 and 395, and related broadcasts. This is the conflict between Germany and the EU and the U.S. and the U.K. about the Menwith Hill listening station and the Echelon network. And as we have seen, that August of 98 was when I first conceptualized the attack on the Menwith Hill station as an act of war and in the information age, the equivalent of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Again, an analysis that resonates rather significantly in the wake of September 11th. It was in that month that the physical and electronic surveillance on the Hamburg cell that launched 911 was in place. It was also in that month when Osama bin Laden stopped using his satellite phone, lest the NSA and U.S. intelligence be able to determine his precise whereabouts. That same month, by the way, saw the attack on the U.S. embassies in Africa. It also saw Bill Clinton's military response. Also, interestingly, at that time, Bill Clinton was under attack from the Republican right and was facing impeachment. So it was a very, very interesting month indeed. Now, noting bin Laden's cessation of the use of his satellite phone and what I have conceived of as the Battle of Menwith Hill, note that it was the bin Laden satellite phone conception that appears to have permitted his escape at the Battle of Tora Bora. In other words, bin Laden, having been alerted to the capabilities of the U.S. monitoring his cell phone, was able to escape from Afghanistan. And that escape is described as follows in the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, January 21st of 2003. This is a Washington Post article by Peter Finn, dateline Rabat, Morocco, headlined, Guards' phone ploy helped bin Laden flee, Moroccans say. It reads in part as follows. With U.S. forces closing in on him, Osama bin Laden deceived U.S. spy technology and vanished into the mountains that led to Pakistan in late 2001, according to senior Moroccan officials. A Moroccan who was one of bin Laden's longtime bodyguards took possession of the al-Qaeda leader's satellite phone on the assumption that U.S. intelligence agencies were monitoring it to get a fix on their position, said the officials, who have interviewed the bodyguard Abdallah Tabarak. Tabarak moved away from bin Laden and his entourage as they fled. He continued to use the phone in an effort to divert the Americans and allow bin Laden to escape. Tabarak was captured in the Tora Bora Mountains in possession of the phone, officials said. Quote, "He agreed to be captured or die," unquote, a Moroccan official said of Tabarak, again quoting, "That's the level of his fanaticism for bin Laden. It wasn't a lot of time, but it was enough." So again, note that bin Laden's awareness of his satellite phone and its liabilities figured prominently, apparently, according to Moroccan authorities, in his escape. And again, in terms of signal intelligence on September 11th and understanding this vast geopolitical struggle of which September 11th and the Iraqi situation are part, bear in mind my analysis of the Battle of Menwith Hill, as I've called it. Now, in this past week, and again, this is being recorded on January 23rd of 2003, Donald Rumsfeld has manifested himself as the north end of a southbound horse in characterizing France and Germany as old Europe. France and Germany, by the way, have combined in this past week not only to oppose an early start to a war in Iraq, but also to make a very significant proposed change in the governing of the European Union. Now, as I said in the first half of the broadcast, bear in mind also the theories of the ancient Chinese military theoretician Sun Tzu. When I talk about the Underground Reich, when I talk about the Bush administration as the point element of the Bormann Group and the Underground Reich, I think some members of this administration are in the know, so to speak, chiefly Karl Rove. I would bet my reputation, if there are a way of verifying it, that should intelligence agencies monitor Karl Rove closely enough, he would turn out to be the point man of the Bormann organization in this administration. I also suspect Grover Norquist is another key conscious Bormann operative. Others, however, are functioning in a manner that is deleterious to the United States, advantageous to the Underground Reich in this von Clausewitzian struggle, but they are behaving in this manner out of stupidity, greed, and other less glamorous motivations. I suspect, for example, that it is my view, I should say, that the main motivation of the Bush administration in Iraq is oil. Heck, look at Cheney, look at Bush, look at the top State Department official in charge of U.S. Middle Eastern policy. That's Elizabeth Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter. I also think that simply distracting the American people from what is going on in this country is another major motivation for Bush. Someone asked me this past week what I thought George Bush was going to do with the economy. What do you think he's going to do with the economy? He knows as much about economics as he does about the Grateful Dead. So one should understand in this context that not all of the players are fully aware of the lay of the land, I suspect. Donald Rumsfeld, again, has been less than deft in characterizing France and Germany as the old Europe. But again, one wants to understand least. One wants to understand von Clausewitz. And as I've discussed in many For the Record programs, Germany, during World War II, assumed economic control of France, and that control extended into the post-World War II period. That's something that I've discussed in, among other broadcasts, For the Record 366, For the Record 372, as well as number 305, and in some of the programs between 298 and 302 dealing with German economic control of the French corporate structure. It's also discussed in number 276 as well. Now, as France and Germany were opposing an early start to a war in Iraq, and in Germany's case, a complete opposition to war in Iraq, note the primary role of Germany in helping to equip Saddam Hussein with his weapons of mass destruction. Note also that the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush were involved in that same arming, and the point man for the Reagan administration in the arming of Iraq was the elder George Bush, not something one should overlook in this context. As France and Germany, France at this point basically having had its corporate structure folded into German corporate control, as they were opposing war, as they were basically opposing the U.S.'s Middle East policy, France and Germany have also been uniting in a very significant move to dominate the European Union. the United Kingdom opposed the German plans for a Kaiser, as they put it, to lead Europe. Eventually, France, which was initially opposed to this, grouped with Germany. And I would note that France is now being headed by a conservative government of Jacques Chirac. And like many other countries in Europe, France is moving to the right. And that's something to bear in mind as the discussion of the conflict between the U.S. and Europe unfolds. Financial Times of Thursday, January 2nd of 2003 had the following story about British opposition to the German plan for a EU Kaiser, so to speak. This is by Christopher Adams and James Blitz in London, headlined, UK attacks German plans for Kaiser to lead Europe. It reads in part, Dennis McShane, Britain's Europe minister, has accused Germany of wanting to appoint an all-powerful Kaiser at the top of the European Commission, and warned Gerhard Schröder, Germany's chancellor, that the English decapitated such a figure 350 years ago. In an interview with the Financial Times, Mr. McShane dismissed suggestions that Britain might lose influence in Europe to a renascent Franco-German axis. He attacked the German proposals for a stronger head of the Commission, arguing that they would sideline national governments and their leadership. One idea being touted by Joschka Fischer, Germany's foreign minister, is for a single person to be president of both the Commission and the European Council, the body representing member states. At December's European Union summit, France backed Britain by supporting alternative proposals for the appointment of a new EU president to head the European Council. Mr. McShane said, quote, I was very struck at Copenhagen by how France completely lined up with Blair on the necessity for an elected chairman of the European Council of Ministers, whereas the German position is for giving all power to a new kind of European Kaiser, a commission president who will tell all the other European institutions what to do. Quote, I had long discussions with Gerhard Schröder on this, and I explained that 350 years ago, we separated a king's head from his body because we didn't want to take orders from one individual. I would note not only the German corporate control of French corporations, in other words, control by corporate Germany of corporate France, but that following the French elections and the assumption of power of a more conservative and more right-leaning French government, the French have lined up with the Germans. So in analyzing the conflict between the U.S. and Britain, Anglo-Saxonia, as I have called it, and Germania on the other side over matters like the Middle East, understand that this is part of a long geopolitical struggle that predates not only the current unpleasantness in the Middle East, but that actually goes back to the 19th century, and certainly both world wars were part of this geopolitical struggle. And again, one should not oversimplify it. There was an accurate and resonant analysis of this struggle, and in particular the German and French maneuvering, in the New York Times, and their conservative columnist William Safire had a column called Bad Hair Dye. It's a pun on hair, spelled H-E-R-R, referring to the German word for sir. It talks about Chancellor Schröder, who also filed a lawsuit over the fact that some German media were charging that he dyed his hair. This is from the New York Times of Thursday, January 23rd of 2003. This article is Dateline Washington, reads in part, Germany's Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, is on a roll. Three battles, three victories, electoral, diplomatic, and judicial. By the way, the judicial is an allusion to his suit over the hair dyeing or alleged hair dyeing. We're not going to talk about that. The first was re-election last year, snatched from the jaws of defeat by his last-minute embrace of anti-American pacifism. That energized the Green Party and empowered Germany's new isolationism. In its wake came the second Schröder triumph, his recent spin-around of Jacques Chirac of France. Chirac had made a deal with the U.S. last fall. We agreed to postpone the invasion of Iraq until after U.N. inspectors had been jerked around long enough to satisfy the world's street opinion, and in return, France would not demand a second U.N. resolution before Allied forces overthrow Saddam. As D-Day approached, France sent its aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle to the coming war zone. Chirac made plain that though a minor and reluctant participant in the attack, France was not to be frozen out of post-war oil arrangements. Then, Schrader, reliant on his militantly anti-war Greens, made Chirac an offer he could not refuse: to permanently assert Franco-German dominance over the 23 other nations of continental Europe. In a stunning power play in Brussels, Germany and France moved to change the practice of having a rotating presidency of the European Council, which now gives smaller nations influence, to a system with a long-term president. This Franco-German czar of the European Union would dominate a toothless president of the European Commission, chosen by the European Parliament. Little guys of Europe hollered bloody murder this week, but will find it hard to resist the Franco-German steamroller. France then had to repay Schroeder by double-crossing the U.S. at the UN. That explains France's startling threat to veto a new UN resolution okaying the invasion of Iraq, a second resolution that France had promised Colin Powell would not be needed. And again, as I analyze the power politics here, one should not oversimplify it, and also one should bear in mind my own deep reservations about the situation in the Middle East. I think the U.S. may very well be falling into an underground Reich trap formulated near the end of or in the immediate aftermath of World War II, in which the U.S. and Britain and Germany would be destroyed in a war with underground Reich proxy warriors drawn from the Muslim populations of the world and what the Germans called the Earth Island, or the German geopoliticians called the Earth Island. Bear in mind also the Serpent's Walk scenario that I've spoken about, in which a bioterror attack on the United States wipes out much of the population, including, by the way, those areas that voted for Al Gore in 2000. Martial law is declared, the underground Reich, which has infiltrated the U.S. Army and gained control of the media, then take over the U.S. and the rest of the world. Israel, by the way, gets wiped out. Now, considering the concept of German economic imperialism as enunciated by Friedrich Liest and as realized by the European Monetary Union, dominated by Germany, which had folded the corporations of occupied Europe into its control during World War II, consider also the following. There is a very interesting article which I think is symbolic and substantive in its outlines, and this was the pronunciation by Greta Duesenberg, the wife of Wim Duesenberg, the head of the European Central Bank, the central bank of the European Monetary Union. She had some very interesting things to say vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, bear in mind in the context of what follows, three things. The primary bankroller of the PLO is and always has been Saudi Arabia, although the Saudis despise the Palestinians. They hate only the Israelis and Jews and communists as much as the Palestinians. And indeed, they viewed the Palestinians as communists. But for Arab world realpolitik, Saudi Arabia has always been the principal bankroller of the PLO. The principal bankroller of the Palestinian Authority is the European Union. And let's take a look at the statements of the wife of Wim Duesenberg, the head of the European Central Bank, in connection with this other aspect of proxy war, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Note also, as we've seen in many programs, that the underground Reich is also present in the Israeli right wing. My own view of Israel is that it's economically irrelevant, that it basically is a Konzentrationslager, as the Germans called it, a concentration camp, not yet an extermination camp like Auschwitz, but a concentration camp in which the world's Jewish population has been concentrated into a particular area. I think that ultimately it is very probable that it will be exterminated as per the plans of the underground Reich, but they have effectively controlled the Israeli right and also kept the world Jewish community relatively silent about the post-war continuation of the Third Reich. New York Times, Thursday, January 9th of 2003, had a very interesting article by Gregory Crouch. This is datelined in the Netherlands. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the city. Pro-Palestinian wife of Europe's banker upsets the Dutch. This article reads in part, "Here and abroad, some Palestinians treat Greta Duesenberg like a queen. Yasser Arafat refers to Ms. Duesenberg as Her Excellency. She's not a queen, and her husband, Wim Duesenberg, is not a king or a prince. Mr. Duesenberg is president, however, of the European Central Bank, the European version of the Federal Reserve, and the political activism of his wife on behalf of Palestinian causes has created a royal problem for him and their country, the Netherlands. Skipping down. The Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs said diplomatic passports issued to civil servants and their spouses should only be used on official business. One Dutch politician has called on the government to rescind Ms. Duesenberg's diplomatic privileges. She has used these on behalf of Yasser Arafat. Skipping down. Ms. Duesenberg first drew attention last April after she draped a Palestinian flag over a balcony outside the couple's Amsterdam home. Quote, "That came straight from my heart because I wanted to show what my feelings were," she said. That display in turn led to a rally speech and petitions along with contributions to a pro-Palestinian website. Some Jewish groups were outraged several months ago after a radio interview Ms. Duesenberg gave. The reporter in that interview asked her how many signatures she intended to collect for a pro-Palestinian petition. She paused, laughed, and then responded, 6 million? Question mark. I think that ostensibly lighthearted comment is not only very revealing, but it also is very significant in terms of this geopolitical struggle, masquerading as, quote, anti-Zionism, unquote, not only in Europe, but in particular in the United States on the American left, is in fact a rather tangible anti-Semitism. Note also that Yasser Arafat was not only very close to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, but was a protege of Otto Skorzeny, the SS colonel and commando extraordinaire who worked for Galen and was one of the leaders of the post-World War II Odessa Underground. This geopolitical struggle between Europe, or between Germania and Europe, the European Union, European Monetary Union, and Anglo-Saxonia, using proxy warriors mobilized by this virtual state, has, I think, as its ultimate goal the economic subjugation or disintegration of the United States, and we're going to talk about that a little later. What we should note here is the fact that there are a number of things at work here in the European hostility to American policy, and this is not to endorse the policies of the Bush administration, as I would think that veteran listeners would be rather clear on. I do not support those policies, but they're not all wrong, and lurking beneath the clumsy, almost kamikaze-like diplomacy of the Bush administration is a much more important and poorly understood conflict. Financial Times of August 31st and September 1st of 2002 had an article by Michael Ignatieff from the Kennedy School of Government. It's called The Divided West, and it's talking about the difference between Europe and the U.S. over September 11th. Talking about 2001, by November and December, the European left had found its voice. Al-Qaeda's attacks were indefensible, it was said, but they represented the Palestinians, the dispossessed of the Third World, and the victims of U.S. imperialism everywhere. Faced with terrorism, the European left simply changed the subject. Instead of hunting down Al-Qaeda, it said, we should be canceling Third World debt and tackling the manifold injustices of a global order built on free trade. Only a minority of European public opinion lent support to these sentiments, but the minority was vocal enough to give Americans the sense that they were more alone than they thought. Later on in the article, this writer, Michael Ignatieff, also spoke about the fact that Europeans were scared. America's allies may say they are all targets now, but they hope and believe that in the globalization of terrorism as spectacle, Big Ben, the Eiffel Tower, the Reichstag, or St. Peter's in Rome will remain just tourist attractions, not military objectives for the assassins of Al-Qaeda. Again, the concept of proxy war is essential here. Note also that Europe is actually moving to the right, and anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant sentiment is at the core of that. Another article from the Financial Times, this from Thursday, November 28th of 2002 by John Lloyd, talks about the anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim sentiment that is fueling a rightward surge by Europe. We've spoken about this in some of our discussions with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day. This article is titled, No to Brussels, No to Immigration, How Right-Wing Populism Entered the Mainstream. And after talking about Jörg Haider's success in Austria, skipping down, and if Mr. Haider's party is floundering, others are not. The Swiss People's Party, led by the businessman Christoph Blocher, almost won a referendum it had called for on the issue of banning all except relatively wealthy asylum seekers from Switzerland, one of the richest countries on earth. Quote, "We were on our own," said Mr. Blocher, euphoric after the vote on Sunday, voicing the common anti-establishment theme of all the populist parties, quote, "against the cabinet, all the other parties in the media, and yet we finally lost by only a handful of votes." Elsewhere in Europe, right-wing populism still surges. The October conference of the Danish People's Party was an exultant affair of a vastly successful grouping that had risen to become third party in the elections of the previous November. The author then goes on to discuss other parties such as the Liga Norda in Italy and other right-wing populist parties. Consider that in connection with the European opposition in the context of this complex thesis. Also consider yet another article from the Financial Times, this from Monday, December 30th of 2002. This is an article by Harold James, a professor at Princeton University. Lessons to learn from the decline and fall of empire. And after talking about the Roman Empire and the British Empire, he goes on to note the economic vulnerability of American primacy in the world. Skipping down, the U.S., unlike the British Empire, is building its rule on a foundation that is potentially quite unstable. The British Empire in its 19th century heyday ran enormous current account surpluses, 7% of gross domestic product on the eve of the First World War. For more than 20 years, in the period of its Cold War victory and of the conversion of the world to a new consensus about markets, the U.S. has had quite large current account deficits. In 2001, the deficit was 4.2% of GDP. One way of reading this odd situation, which is popular with many Americans, is that the rest of the world has bought into U.S. stability. The deficits are financed by capital inflows as the non-American world buys the stock of fast-growing U.S. companies or, when the stock market looks bad, property. Skipping down, but nobody thinks this kind of inflow can be sustained indefinitely. The inflows of foreign capital could be rapidly reversed on some chance piece of bad news, parenthetically, such as terrorism. Such a reversal would involve a collapse of the U.S. stock market, the property market, and the dollar. U.S. consumers would no longer be able to binge on cheap goods supplied by the rest of the world. American producers would try to protect their markets, foreign producers would be thrown out of business, and no longer see any gains to be realized by peaceful integration in a benign world economy. The financial reversal would also bring the collapse of the U.S. security policy and its calculated strategy of world pacification. The cost of U.S. defense spending would look much too high, and scaling it down would give a chance to would-be rivals, at least on a regional basis, China, for example. The American case would then look more like that of Spain, which also ran a current account deficit financed by the outflow of precious metals from its imperial possessions than that of 19th century Britain. And Gibbon's story of decline, in this case of the Roman Empire, would begin. And again, I've spoken about the economic component to this geopolitical struggle in connection with September 11th. For the records, 344 through 46, 365 through 367, among other broadcasts. This concludes For the Record program number 396, Economics, Geopolitics, and Proxy War in the Middle East. This is being recorded on January 26th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.